talks about the defense system and the budget. And I serve on the budget committee. I know the pressures on the Congress. I know the pressures on the executive branch. I know all the competing programs, and nearly all have some justification. But it seems to me that we've got to have a priority in this country, and the priority's got to be we're going to remain strong for the sake of peace. When he says in 1972 it would be a tragedy to cut the defense budget, and these are Governor Carter's words, then he says in 75 we ought to cut it $15 billion. Then he says in 76 we ought to cut $5 to $7 billion. At the very time Secretary Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, is saying we ought to increase the real defense budget for a number of good reasons, then I ask again the American people, do we want a man in the White House with no demonstrated experience and no demonstrated leadership in this field? No experience at all in foreign affairs. President Ford was a ranking Republican on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee in the House for a number of years. He understands our defense needs, and he's kept the pace since he's left the Congress and been vice president and president. I just say, take a good hard look. We're not perfect. We've made mistakes. You'll not agree with everything that we've said or we've done. But take a look at that mass of contradictions, of some of the weird judgments and weird performance by Governor Carter. And finally, with respect to agriculture, and I know the pride and the importance of agriculture in the great state of Vermont, I served as Senator Aitken on the Ag Committee. That was a great privilege for me and a great thrill for me, and we miss him in the Senate of the United States. But I'm from a farm state. I'm from a dairy state, a wheat state, a corn state, a soybean state. We understand the importance of agriculture, not just to rural Kansas, but to all Kansas. It's just as important here. And I can only add that come January, and I've discussed this with the president, one of my roles as vice president will be being a voice for the farmer, a proper voice for the farmer, based on what I've heard the last couple of days. A responsible voice for the farmer, a tasteful voice for the farmer, in an effort to expand our exports, to build up our agriculture, and above all, to give the American farmer the freedom he wants to plant, the freedom he wants in his dairy operation, and doing what we can to get the government off his back. And if you see some of the pamphlets floating around that farmers were insulted by, how to care for your livestock, safety around cattle, it says don't talk too loud, you might disturb the cattle. That came as great news in my state to cattlemen. So don't step in the manure, it may be slippery. That came as greater news in my state. And that's the kind of waste and hogwash that ought to be eliminated. Didn't serve any useful purpose. I guess it provided some employment. Didn't do much for the cows either. But I've seen... I've said in defense of farmers, as bad as that booklet was, as much red tape as they have and as much government interference as they've had, it's getting better all the time under our administration. I imagine a few may be talking to the cows from time to time, just trying to get to talk to someone who understands their problem. It's sometimes more helpful than talking to some bureaucrat. You don't have to drive as far. So it's great to be here. It's a pleasure to be here, and I ask you as earnestly as I can, well, we want you to vote for us on November 2nd, but more importantly, we need your help. If you've got friends and relatives in some other state, drop them a postcard and tell them what a great ticket this is. Or you can just drop my name. Tell them what a great president we have. We want him elected. Thank you very much.
Well, let me say, first of all, this is an unexpected privilege and opportunity. I didn't know they were going to ask me to say anything. I've been trying to think what I might say, but I've been in Maine a number of times, and I know there are probably Democrats and Independents and Republicans in the audience. I just hope that you look over both the tickets and then vote for us, of course.
Such as Maine than you had planned to do earlier, for example?
Not that I know. I mean, I you know, we've been traveling around the country. I've been in 32 or 3 states at this point. No real pattern. We were going in a number of areas for fundraisers, other areas where the polls indicated we had some strength where we might solidify our support, others where there was an erosion of the Carter support. And we just believe that Maine... it's a state that we can carry in November, and that's only 30 days from now, so we've got a lot of work to do.
Do you anticipate a large voter turnout in November, and perhaps your comments, if you have any, on what sort of breakdown you expect? Are we going to see a Nixon-Kennedy type of vote very close, or a McGovern-Nixon vote that was completely apart?
Well, my own view is it's going to be very close, and I could be mistaken. There's a lot of movement in this campaign, and I feel the movement's toward us. I could be wrong, and the last thing I want to do is prophesy something that's unlikely of happening. My projection is going to be a close race, but the President Ford will win if the movement continues in the direction it's going now, because we start off by convention time with a 32-point lead that Carter had, and now it's down to either 8 or 11 or whatever poll you may look at. We're coming on strong, the President is, and I think we can win in a fast finish.
Debate 1 is now history, and I've heard it said that if it wasn't a draw, at least close. There was no great disparity between how each man presented himself. How about debate 2 or debate 3? Would you expect President Ford to be perhaps stronger in foreign policy, make a stronger impact?
I should think he'd be much stronger in foreign policy. Domestic policy was supposed to be Carter's big suit. I don't know that it was all that close. Every poll I saw indicated that Ford was a clear winner. And I should think he'd be a clear winner in the second debate. The final debate, I think I would want to wait and see the second debate before I made a projection. The third debate, of course, would be the debate between myself and Senator Mondale. The 15th of October, I guess.
People of Maine are probably as concerned about any problem that either side, either camp, has talked about and discussed. Is there any one convincing argument that you could say to a Maine farmer or a Maine shipyard worker that, yes, you should vote for Ford and not Jimmy Carter?
I think you boil it all down. I want to pick out the one thing. It's the experience of leadership. It's really two words that sort of goes into the same concept. It seems to me that President Ford has the experience, a great deal of it. He's had the leadership. He's been the president. He believes in a strong defense for this country. And I'm just convinced that when the American people make that final judgment, they may come out very closely. But I really believe they're going to say, well, which man can provide the leadership? Who do I have the confidence in? President Ford is predictable. He's dependable. And I don't want to pick and criticize Governor Carter, but he hasn't had the experience. He has a number of positions on a number on the same issue. I think that's President Ford's strong suit.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Dole, surely you've heard the remarks that Secretary Butts made, the comment that he made, and that must bother you to some degree, doesn't it?
Well, I've said, I think, about all I can say, that they were totally tasteless, and I don't know if it's a private conversation he was having. I know it wasn't an interview, but I said that I think the American people are tired of statements by candidates or public officials, and then followed up by apologies, and I say that's true whether it's Butts or Governor Carter, whoever feels compelled to make such a statement and apologize for it. I don't like it, but I understand the President has reprimanded Secretary Butts, and Secretary Butts has apologized publicly.
It's not the first time that he's made a remark that has offended a lot of people, and I wondered if you thought, if you had the decision to make yourself, would you ask him to quit?
Well, I think I'll let the President, it's his cabinet, and let him make that decision.
One other thing I wanted to ask you is that Jimmy Carter has said that President Ford is being inaccessible during this campaign, and people have tagged you from the beginning as, well, you've been called the hatchet man, or the person who's doing the footwork, the legwork for the campaign. Well, what are your own thoughts about that?
Well, you're absolutely correct. I've been tagged as the hatchet man before I ever said a word. Certain elements in the press said, now here goes the hatchet man. I hadn't even opened my mouth. And that's how you get tagged in this business, by the media sometimes, and I don't know if it's a fair characterization or not, but I'm not going to let Carter have three positions on every issue. President Ford, on the other hand, is totally accessible. He's being the President of the United States, he's being presidential. He stayed in the White House, and had he gone out of the White House, certain as I'm sitting here, Carter would say, why aren't you back in the White House attending business? Don't you want to be president? So, you know, we know the game. Governor Carter would have busted the President be president. He wants to be president so badly, he'll promise you anything. Doesn't say he's going to pay for it, but he'll make the promise.
Would you rather see Mr. Ford out meeting more people and more campaign appearances than staying in the White House?
Well, I think now that the Congress is gone, it's safe to leave town. But, you know, you've got the liberals running around Washington spending everybody's money. You better stay right there. At least you can veto a few bills, and you don't dare leave for too long. But the Congress, I guess, finally pulled out of Washington last night, during the night sometime, in the cover of darkness. And I think now the president can safely proceed to other areas. And he's going on a six-day trip to the West Coast. He'll be back, coming back through Texas and Oklahoma. So he's out on the road. Only 30 days to go, and we're going to win the election. And I think President Ford will be a great asset on the road.
What do you think is going to happen between now and then that will finally turn the tide and close the gap?
Oh, I think if the tide is, I don't know if it's a tide, but it's a movement. It's moving away from Carter and toward President Ford. And it's a perceptible change. And it seems to me that come November 2nd, maybe even before, you'll find President Ford ahead in the polls. And there are signs now that Governor Carter is sort of desperate. He's called the press together privately and chastised them, saying he wasn't treated fairly. The president got all the softballs, and it's an indication to me that he's getting a little desperate.
Now, as you know, the issue of lowering Air Force Base is a critical one to the state of Maine and to Maine's economy. Governor Carter says he would not promise to keep it open, just as a political promise to get votes. But he does recognize its importance. I wonder what your thoughts were about that. Are there any promises you can make about keeping Loring open?
I can't make any promises, but I can promise to be sympathetic. I've read a summary, of course, about Loring Air Force Base. I know the number of jobs involved. I think it's a highly important base. I have my own view, but it's not in the closing stage. I have one out near Kansas in that state, so I understand the pressures when somebody talks about base closing. I would just say that we hope to have a meeting later on today with a committee that's been formed to keep the base open. I hope to have a chance to visit with them, have their input, take it back to the president, and do what I can to be of assistance.
Have you ever regretted voting in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment?
Can't think of
any second thoughts about it.
No,
you still support it.
Still support it. You know, everybody jokes about women have more rights now than men and all those things, but I think it's a step in the right direction. I thought so at the time. Kansas has always been a progressive state in this area, and there's some who are very much opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment, but I'm on record voting for it and support it.
I have one more question, and that is that before the campaign is over, you will have your chance to debate
right.
Mr. Mondale, and not much talk has been made about that to date. What sort of plan do you have? What sort of attack do you have? A strategy do you have to deal with Mr. Mondale in debate?
Well, you're right. There hasn't been much said about that debate, and it falls on a Friday night unless it's changed, which is the night that every high school team in America plays football. And you add up the number of people who'll be attending those football games, there may not be anybody left at home to turn on the TV set. So I guess my friends and his friends, plus the press that followed each of us, will be watching. We are constrained, of course, because, you know, I'm number two on our ticket. He's number two on the Carter ticket. And we're not out there to make policy and suggest we might do something if we're elected or do this if we're elected. We're pretty much in the supporting role, of course, so I don't see any new ground being broken, but it should be interesting. I understand we'll be talking about defense and domestic policy and many other matters, but it'll probably be a shoring up process as far as our own, as far as President Ford's concerned. I'll be doing that and trying to chip away a little bit at Carter, and I'm certain Senator Mondale was very able. We'll be doing the very same thing on the other side.
You think you can promise it can compete with the football classic?
Well, if I had a choice, I'd go to the football game. But I don't have a choice.
Okay.
Specifically going to prepare for your debate with Senator Mondale?
Well, to be very honest, we haven't done a lot. understand there's a meeting today to work out details of the place and how long the debate's going to be. As far as I'm concerned, 90 minutes is about 30 minutes too long. Some may think it's 90 minutes too long. But we're still working out specifics. So we have some president's briefing books and other briefing material. And I assume we'll do pretty much what anyone does. You look over everything you can, and you cram for this and cram for that, and try to be prepared. But it's pretty hard, frankly, when you're on the road as much as we've been. And when you go from 6 or 7 in the morning till 9 or 10 at night, with 18 minutes built in for personal time and our great scheduling effort, much time for preparation.
Will you be going through the same kinds of preparation techniques that the president has, and that is practicing with your staff and that kind of thing?
Oh, maybe if we have time. It's just a matter of how much time we have. First, we have to get all the material together, then have a chance to look at it ourselves, and then try to weed out parts of it, and then you get into the Q&A period with your staff and others. I assume we'll do that. It's going to be something we'll be prepared for, but it's like getting ready for the final exam. You study all the wrong questions, and that could happen. I hope not.
New England, as you know, relies very heavily on heating oil, up to 80%. Some reports are now saying that heating oil and gasoline is going to hit 80, 90, perhaps even a dollar a gallon. Do you and President Ford have any specific suggestions or ideas for relief for New England homeowners who heat with oil? Or do anything with oil, for that matter?
Well, I think probably in the long run, you're going to have to look. We're going to have to find some alternate sources of energy, either solar or nuclear in the right sense, and I understand some of the problems of that. It seems to some of us that we haven't really done anything in energy. I'm talking about the Congress now. The President sent messages to Congress, proposals to Congress. We're still importing more and more oil. In fact, the percentage is going up. We've taken away, in fact, the incentives in the oil and gas-producing areas, some of the tax incentives that would get people into the exploration business. At the same time, we're talking about the greater need. Is it great here? Is it great in the Midwest? There could be a natural gas shortage. I don't have any pat answers, no, but I think we've got to get into the ERDA process, the research and development, find some alternate sources, develop the sources we have, and that's essentially what the President's recommended.
Are you blaming the Congress then for lack of action?
I think there's enough blame to go around. I'm in the Congress, so I'll take some of that heat. But I want to point out to those who, it's easy to point at the president, whether he's a Democrat or Republican. But and I've pointed now and then we had Democrats in the White House. But the Democrats control this Congress, and they've controlled it for 22 years. And they keep talking every year about all the problems in the country. We have to look at Congress and say, well, what have they done? And they haven't done much. Someone suggested one time that we could just bag the hot air in the Senate and sell it to get enough energy for everyone. We haven't really produced any energy. That's the point of it.
The President has just recently announced his new war on crime, the expansion of the national parks concept, and so on. These are things that have happened just 30 days prior to the election.
The issue of tax loopholes has no chance to have the tax loopholes that the government has, and the Republicans are very much in favor of the tax structure.
Well, I think there we have to define loophole. One man's loophole may be another man's incentive, and I'm on the Finance Committee. We've just finished, I think the President will probably sign, I don't know that for certain, the tax bill, which closes a great many loopholes, limits the so-called tax shelters, raises the minimum tax, so everybody pays some tax. But, you know, it's a bit hypocritical for Governor Carter to talk about loopholes when his 75 tax liability was $68,000 and he subtracted $41,000. In other words, just took that much off his income tax because of the investment tax credit. Now, is that a loophole? I've asked Governor Carter this many times. I don't know many people in Maine or my state of Kansas who even pay $41,000. If you take off this loophole that Carter deducted, it means he only paid about 12.8% of his income, which is over $100,000 in taxes. So, you know, let's define what loopholes are.
Senator, latest figures as far as the economy are not too good. Inventories are up, unemployment is up. The Ford administration says we're way on our way to recovery. Do you see this as recovery?
I think we're in, I think somebody called it a pause. I hope it's only a pause. And, you know, there is a little, I don't want to say slump, but there is a pause. I think generally, from all indications I have and from those who advise the president and others, the economy is still strong. We're whacking away at inflation. Some of the indicators don't look as good as they have, but, you know, it'll take a month or two to really find out if there is any problem. I don't think so.
Senator, a major issue in the primaries between President Ford and Governor Reagan concerned the Panama Canal. Is there any difference in your position on the Panama Canal and President Ford's?
I don't think so. I mean, no one ever wanted to give away the Panama Canal, and I might add that I haven't heard. I've been in 33 states, and we've had a number of press conferences and, you know, just visits with constituents. I think that question has come up maybe two or three times. So it was focused on foreign policy. It was a good issue for Governor Reagan. I think he made his point. I think perhaps it may have had some impact on President Ford, but, you know, we're still going to go through the normal process, because any treaty made has to be ratified by the Senate. We're just in the negotiating stage. We have to keep negotiations open. So I don't see any difference in my position in President Ford's, unless there's been some change that I'm not aware of.
Mr. Butts is still in his position. The Democrats are saying now that that fact is an indication that Mr. Ford approves of Mr. Butts personally as well as professionally. Do you think
by the president, this a very strong reprimand. I understand he's offered a public apology. I haven't read the text of that apology.
This is not new. This isn't the first time this sort of thing has happened with Mr. Butts.
It's the second time it's happened. It's much like Governor Carter calling former President Johnson a liar and a cheat and calling his widow and saying, I'm sorry. I don't know what he's going to tell Billy Graham when he calls him for what his son said about him. But you have all these people running around making statements. I think the American people are tired of Butts or Carter or anyone else saying one thing and running to the phone to make an apology. It just seems to me that we ought to be a little more careful in what we say, and I've probably made mistakes myself, but try not to.
Does the Ford administration, or the future Ford administration, if all goes well, in November, feel the same way about deregulation of fuel, gas, and oil?
I think so. I don't see any change. I think we're up against it. If we're going to get people to go out and invest their money and try to produce energy and look for alternate sources of energy, we've got to provide some incentive. I don't suggest we ought to let the price go out of sight, but you know, how do we know until we've tried it? And we're just lucky we haven't had another embargo of any kind. I think it would be critical if that happened.
Can I follow it up and ask you this, though? If you think that we're up against it, the oil companies are up against it,
I don't suggest
the people here in Maine are up against it.
No doubt about it. They're the ones who really up. It's the user that's up against it. That's what I meant. I'm not talking have any brief for the oil companies. I'm just suggesting that we're going to bring some reason to an energy policy. We've got to have the Congress and the president working together. Senator Jackson thought he could become president by attacking oil companies. Well, they have a lot of faults, and I said from the start, if they make excessive profits, there ought to be an excess profits tax. But on the other hand, I don't know what we achieve. I come from a state where we have small independent producers, where we've taken away most of the incentives for these small independents to go out and look for oil and or gas. And why should they go out and look for a source for energy when they can't make a profit? Leaves the people in this area up against it. You're right, because we're importing most of that oil, and the prices are going up.
There's been a number of recent published reports that the United States Navy is falling far behind the Soviet Navy. Do you think the Ford administration will advocate an increased strategic role for the Navy and more capital ships?
Well, I say I guess so. I read the one report, I think, last week or the week before about how we're falling behind. I know of a little about the president's program in that area, and it applies to
building frigates in Maine. I think it's all in the works, and I hope it's increased from 8 to 12. That means a lot of jobs, and beyond that, it ties in with President Ford's position for a strong defense. Now, you get into all the budget arguments. Is it budget or is it not? I think it is. And I think we ought to press ahead. And I would say, on the other hand, without trying to snipe at Governor Carter, here's a man who comes to Maine and says, well, I want to cut $5 to $7 billion in defense. At the very time Secretary Rumsfeld is saying we're going to have to add $18 to $20 billion. And it just seems to me that we don't just spend defense money to... It's not a waste. We're talking about being first for peace, not for any other reason. That's the very broad answer.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Proposed military installation such as Loring Air Force Base in Maine. He also said that he would not promise to keep Loring open to gain votes in Maine. Were there, quote, political considerations involved in the decision to close Loring Air Force Base and to award a $30 million machine gun contract to a Belgian firm over the Mammoth Corporation in Maine?
Well, it's a typical Carter statement to say that suggests that political factors involved and not be any more specific. As far as I know, there were no political factors involved. And I would just to add to that, did he also advocate cutting defense spending while he was up here criticizing? It's not a closing, it's just one that indicated there might be a closing. If we had taken the past 6 to 8 to 10 years, the cuts made by the Liberal Democrats in the Congress, some $30 to $40 billion in defense, that gives us an answer to a lot of questions. And then for Carter to have the temerity to come to Maine and say, well, there are political considerations involved in the closing, political considerations involved in this. He ought to be talking about beefing up our defense posture and make a great deal more sense.
Can I just ask you a quick follow-up on that? Is there any possibility that the Ford administration would reconsider the decision to phase out Loring Air Force Base?
Well, I hope so. I think we're going to have a meeting late on here after a while with Bill. And, I'm going to listen and take back any input I can. I read a briefing on it, a letter from someone retained by the committee organized to present the case. I think it's a very important base. In addition, if we look at it not only from the military standpoint, it's important, but from the economic standpoint, it's important. And we're talking about thousands of jobs and probably about 50% of the economy in that area. So it's something we should look at. You know, and I don't think there's been any hard, fast decision made. So I'll look at it and bring it back.
Senator Dole, if the base should be closed, would there be any possibility of government assistance in a transition from a military economy to a civilian economy?
There is that assistance. In fact, I'm sort of an expert in that because they've closed a couple of my bases in Kansas, and I wasn't accused of them being closed for political reasons, but that does come very quickly. But I think before you get into that, you ought to make every effort you can to keep it open. And then,
could I only interject? Right. I think one of the problems with Loring is that they have the worst of both worlds. You're talking about an 83% reduction. The base, unlike that of Bangor or Presque Isle, is not turned over to the local community. The military retains the title, so very little can be done.
That makes it hard. Right.
So that makes it even worse economically. So it's not a closed down, but a substantial reduction.
Could you name the bases that did close in Kansas?
Yes, Forbes Air Force Base was the last one, and then before that it was Schilling Air Force Base, and then looking at another one right now for closing called Richards Gebauer, and we're doing the very thing that I hope you're all doing. We're trying to keep it open. If you want to verify that, you can check it out.
Senator, Governor Carter said in a magazine article, I think, that he would favor taxing only the church building itself, but other church property would be not taxing that, but charging other taxing other church property. You criticized him for that statement, I think. Can you tell me what your feelings are about that?
Well, I I think first you have to understand that he made the statement, you know, Governor Carter was making statements, and the press wants us to give our feelings about that. I understand he said later today that was a willful distortion, but he usually didn't tell us what he means. If he just tell us what he means, then he wouldn't get in all this trouble about taxation. And this was in the Liberty Magazine, a Seventh-day Adventist publication, September-October 1976 issue, since current. An interview he had in the back of his limousine driving from somewhere in Ohio to somewhere in West Steubenville to somewhere in West Virginia. And he said, in effect, that he would tax everything except the church itself. Now, if there's some unrelated church income, then we want to leave the law as it is. That's taxed. But I wouldn't change it. That's my position. But what I want to know is, what is his position? He's talking about property tax, income tax, church-owned orphanages or rest homes or hospitals. Or he gets in more trouble with his interviews. There's Playboy or Associated Press, and he just likes to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a question? Do you want to ask
him? Let's sort of take turns here.
Yes, when Governor Carter was here, when it was San Armando, he accused you of leading the fight to leave open a number of tax-free loopholes in your attitude, and he said that on that basis you shouldn't be criticizing the Democrats and on tax reform. Do you have any response to that?
Did he say what they were?
He said you led the fight in the
Senate. Oh, sure. Well, naturally. I didn't expect him up here and endorse the Ford Dole ticket, you know. Now, what is a loophole? You know, we've been trying to get Governor Carter to tell us what's a loophole. I don't know how many of you took off $41,000 in your 75 tax for the investment tax credit, but Governor Carter's taxes in 1975 were $68,000. But they bought some new peanut equipment down in Plains, Georgia, and there's the investment tax credit, which gave him a little, I hope not a loophole, but a little deduction of $41,000. That left his tax liability about $17,000, which is about 12.8% of his income, and I would guess everyone in this room paid more than that. Now, is that what Senator Mondale had reference to? Certainly not. He wouldn't raise that question. But he would raise some big argument without any specifics. That's the old liberal trick. And then blast us for that. He's on the Finance Committee. I'm on the Finance Committee. We offered a couple amendments together. I assume those weren't loopholes. But, you know, he sees it one way and we see it another. We're not advocating that those who have above median incomes have their taxes increased, because we know the median income for an American family is $14,000. Governor Carter's advocating that. He said it in an Associated Press interview. I think they're in deep trouble over there. Tax policies, and so they're running around the country firing blanks.
Senator Dole, then you do think that Governor Carter acted responsibly by taking the $41,000?
I've never quarreled with that. I said I'm for the investment tax credit. But you know what his answer was when he was asked about it? That's why we need to reform our tax laws.
Are you campaigning here against Senator Muskie? Would you? If you are, would you give some personal indication of whether or not you feel he should be replaced in the Senate? Would you comment on his effectiveness?
I'm here campaigning for President Ford. I'll comment on his effectiveness.
Are you going to mention Muskie in any of your campaign expenses?
I'm here also trying to help Republican candidates, but I'm not here to attack Senator Muskie, if that's your point.
Senator Dole, Senator Muskie was one of Jimmy Carter's finalists in his selection for a running mate, and they have agreed to work closely together on a budget if Carter is elected. And former Maine Governor Kenneth Curtis is also a very good friend of Carter's, and Carter stayed at Curtis's home while he was here. There has been some talk in Maine that Curtis might be named to a government post in Washington, possibly to a cabinet seat if Carter were elected. So if Carter were elected, isn't there a possibility that Maine would have a greater voice in Washington because of the relationship between Carter and Muskie and between Carter and Curtis than if the Ford Dole administration? That's the nod.
Well, you're stretching a long way there to make that connection. You know, everybody's always speculated about, Senator Muskie has speculated about being vice president, and maybe for some reason that Carter knew about. And if he's reelected, he will be back in the Senate. I don't know, Governor Curtis, I assume they're speculating about people in my state. They can't put them all in the cabinet. There are only so many cabinet posts, and I assume they're speculating every place they go, they probably drop a name or two. Now they can't all be there. Maybe they're going to, in their reorganization plan, create some more to take care of everyone. But, you know, I can't get into that guessing game. Only Governor Carter knows. We have Bill Cohn and Dave Emery. We've got close ties now to Maine. They're men of the future.
They're obviously kind of a counter-operation and that they are on the other side. Not long before that, or perhaps after at least, in almost the same sequence, you had said that Governor Carter's pettiness or criticism of the press was perhaps an example or an indication of disaster depending. And it has been stated that for those who don't deny that it has been said that your criticism of the Times is all right for you to criticize the press, but it isn't all right for Governor Carter, too. Now, do you...
Oh, there's a vast difference. You probably didn't read it all, or maybe didn't perceive it the way I perceived it. But his was done privately. He calls the press together, and in an effort to intimidate the press, talks about how he's been mistreated and President Ford gets all the softballs. I said mine straight out. I commended the New York Times yesterday for not printing the real words in the Carter interview with Norman Mailer. You know, so it's an even-handed, but I said mine publicly. You have some evidence in New York Times supporting President Ford, maybe I can retract that. All I've said, and I also said that's their right. I made that very clear that was their right. That's a right they have. They can use the editorial page any way they want, and some papers can use the other columns any way they want. But, you know, that's the right they have. I don't operate the New York Times. We get along fairly well with the press. We've had some tough questions, and we've tried to respond. We haven't yet gotten everybody together for a three-hour session and whined about the coverage. I don't like some of the things they write, and they don't like some of the things I say. That makes a free society. It gives her a good, tough exchange. And President Ford is not afraid of scrutiny. I think it was all based on the fact that the president was in the White House and Carter was out campaigning, and Carter is... His margin is slipping away from him because people are beginning to understand he doesn't have any positions, that he wants to be president. That's his objective. But we have, others of us have other objectives. We're concerned about the country and the direction it's going to go.
Can I ask one more question?
Let's get it quickly.
Okay. You were quoted as saying that you thought that partisan, there might have been some partisan motivation in the special prosecutor's investigation of the campaign funds in Michigan. In view of recent published reports which indicate that investigation apparently is going to exonerate President Ford, do you still feel there are partisan considerations involved in the raising of that issue?
I'll reserve judgment on that.
Is President Ford coming to Maine during this campaign?
I don't know.
We're going to be at ease for a few minutes while you have your dessert, and we'll be back with you shortly with...
Good. You hear me in the front? Yes, you can. Well, you know, polls are, there are always someone taking polls, and when you're ahead, it's great. When you're behind, it's hopeful, and when it's over, you're broke. If you lose, that is. I've said for some time, and I thought with some conviction and some basis of fact, that we were gaining on Governor Carter. that or he was falling back. I never was quite certain which was happening, but there was a great deal of movement in the campaign. And we always like to look at polls that show us doing well, and I understand on Monday in Time magazine, Yankelovich's latest poll will show Ford 43, Carter 43, and 14% undecided. That's progress. I think that's progress. It wasn't many weeks ago in Kansas City, in fact, right after Kansas City, I guess, or right before Kansas City, where Governor Carter had a 32-point lead. I think it was 32 points. It was totally unrealistic, but he had the lead because we were still fighting for our nomination. I say that in the proper sense. And he had his wrapped up and delivered to him, and he wrote his own platform, and they had a great party in New York, and he came away from New York buoyed up and encouraged. But then along came our convention, which was very exciting, and many of you were there. And we came out of that convention united. I think the proudest moment in my life in politics was probably standing there with the president after I'd been named as his running mate, but right near the top, was standing there that evening with my wife, Elizabeth, my mother, and my daughter, and watching President Ford and Governor Reagan talk to the American people and demonstrate clearly that the Republican Party was unified for a purpose. And that purpose was victory on November 2nd, not for some selfish Republican reason, but because America needs our leadership. And I said, prior to our convention, we were fortunate. We had two outstanding candidates, and they didn't have any, and that's really what it was all about. As I was going around the room shaking hands, I met a lot of Republicans. I guess if we took a poll in here, we'd probably do better than the one coming out on Monday. I met one young Republican, Mr. Adams, who's 96 years of age. I wonder if he'd stand up. He said if I didn't make it this time, he was going to run in 1980. And as I walked around the room, I saw earlier this evening, I had a chance to visit with my good friend, who was the general counsel of the Republican National Committee when I was privileged to be chairman of the Republican Party, Fred Scribner. Fred's back there somewhere. Fred, where are you? I might say that Fred kept us out of trouble. And I say that advisedly because we were both there during the Watergate times. That was my night off. I think Fred told me to take the night off as I look back on it. But he's a good lawyer and a great Republican and did a great service to our party. And I'm very proud to be here with all the distinguished guests who've been introduced. Some who've gone on to the American Legion for even more inspiration, and they're coming back to meet with a group about lowering Air Force Base after I conclude my remarks. I had the privilege of going over and seeing Bill Rogers and other Legionnaires. Just so happens that the immediate past commander is a Kansan, Harry Wiles, and I think it's rather coincidental that I'm here and he's here, and also the new commander of the American Legion is from Maine, and he's being honored tonight. And I took a little poll while I was walking through the Legionnaires, and I think it's running about 10-1. We found one fellow from Plains. We put him down for Carter. Elizabeth found him, and he's now reconsidering. I told Mr. Rogers I made my first venture into the realm of vice presidential politics by going to Seattle, Washington, to the National Legion Convention. And Governor Carter had been there the day before. And Carter told the American Legion, and repeated his debate with Ford, I might add, that he opposed amnesty for draft evaders, but favored a blanket pardon. Well, I looked up the dictionary before I got there, and the New World Dictionary says, defines amnesty as meaning a general pardon. And so I told the American Legion the next day that the Ford Dole administration would oppose blanket amnesty, blanket pardon, or blanket clemency. And then I told them why. I've said then, I've said since, we still have hundreds of Americans missing in action in Southeast Asia. Some may be alive, I don't know. But until we find out, and until there's an accounting, it just seems to me that our first priority should be, and our first concern should be, to those forgotten Americans and not those who forgot America in a time of need, and that's what it's all about. As I walked around the room, I had a lot of fun walking around the room. You learn a lot by walking around the room. Some of it you can repeat. But I also met Cap Cowan. Where's Cap Cowan? We saved the world together again. But when I got back to my seat at the head table, I found a letter from Cap Cowan. It was a letter his father had written to him. Cap Cowan and I were in the same division, the 10th Mountain Division. This letter was dated April 13, 1945, which was the day after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the day before I had some problems over there in Italy. But it's a very outstanding letter, and I've read it, and I'll read it again. But it indicates what a tragedy war can be. And Cap was telling me in the very brief visit we had that there are a lot of 10th Mountain Division alumni in this area, and I'm very proud to be here for that reason. But I want to discuss tonight, you know, many people wonder how I became the vice presidential nominee, and more people are wondering that every day as we travel around the country. And I've told this so often, but I think it deserves repeating. On August 19th, after Ford had won the nomination the night before and gone to Governor Reagan, and they had talked in the Alameda Plaza Hotel, the next morning the president had to choose, or by the next morning the president had to pick a running mate and appear with that running mate by 12 noon, I guess the deadline was, not deadline, but the announced time, and sort of display the running mate for all to see. And early that morning, the 19th of August, we had heard a commentary which indicated there were still four in the running. It was down to four. And remember, you had to be back in Kansas City by noon. And one was Ann Armstrong, and she was over in Scotland. And I didn't see any how she could possibly get back, so I scratched her off the list, and that left three. Another one on that list was Bill Ruckelshaus in the state of Indiana, a great Republican. But he, at that very moment, was out in Tacoma, Washington. Besides, I thought his name was probably too long for a button, Ruckelshaus. And that left Senator Baker and Senator Dole, and I told my wife, I said, if they don't go in alphabetical order, I think we've got a chance. And so, it wasn't long after we heard that, probably an hour and a half, the press started gathering in the hallway. And we were very fortunate. Our room is right next to the suite occupied by Governor Connally. So I assumed that the commentator had been wrong, and the Governor Connally was going to be on the ticket, and the press was waiting to interview him as he came out to go over to see the president. But in any event, after about 30 or 40 minutes, I told Elizabeth, I said, Elizabeth, go to the door and put your ear down and see what they're saying out in the hallway. Now, that's legal in Kansas City if you listen from the inside out, so there wasn't any problem there. So she did listen, and she heard the name Dole. We didn't know whether they were talking about pineapple juice or somebody making application for relief. But in any event, our name was mentioned, or the name was mentioned. I said last night, I never thought about it. They might have been talking about her, but in any event, the name was mentioned. And so we sort of started getting ready just in case something would happen. But in any event, because of the close proximity to Governor Connie's room and thinking the president might accidentally dial the wrong number, when the phone did ring and the president said hello, I accepted before I identified myself, just in case. And that sort of when it started. We've been working ever since. I had another person in the audience mention to me at the reception that since Governor Carter talks so much about golf and has shown such a keen interest in President Ford's golfing activities, that he ought to learn the game as something he can do in his retirement. I think that's a pretty good recommendation. I'm going to pass that on for whatever it may be worth, because he'll have a lot of time for those things in another 30 days. I want to talk very briefly about what Governor Carter said. He was in Maine yesterday. It seems that everywhere I show up, he's already been there. Right now, we're following Governor Carter, but the way the polls are looking, we'll be ahead of him soon, and I'll be in the place first, and he'll be there after. But in any event, he was in Maine yesterday, and I think that indicates and signifies the importance of this state to the Democrats, and I hope my presence here demonstrates and indicates the importance of this state to President Ford and the Republican Party. Mr. Carter likes to make pious statements. He goes all over the country making pious statements and rather harsh judgments of other people. He said in Maine, he derives all of my support, my advice, my counsel, my strength, my criticisms directly from the American people. Well, fortunately, one thing he isn't getting from the American people is your tax dollar. But he has made it very, very clear here and wherever he goes that as president, he intends to get your tax dollar. Now, first, he clearly stated his general approach to taxation. He said in an Associated Press interview 2 or 3 weeks ago that he didn't think many people wanted their taxes lowered. Now, is there anybody in this audience who doesn't want their taxes lowered? We have a doctor standing by, and we'll be glad to look you over as soon as you hold up your hand. That was Governor Carter's statement. It wasn't Bob Dole's statement. It wasn't President Ford's statement. It was Governor Carter's statement. Well, then he got down to specifics. After he threw that line out, he got down to specifics. He said he would raise taxes on every family with higher than median income. And though he didn't know it at the time, that's half the families in America. Apparently, that's Mr. Carter's idea of tax reform. Median income for American families where the wife works and the husband works or whatever is $14,000. And he goes around and he said in the convention in New York, when he gave his acceptance speech, a very fine acceptance speech, he said the national tax system is a disgrace. And these were his words. He didn't tell you the Democrats have ruled the Congress the last 22 years running. He didn't tell you the Democrats had ruled the Congress 40 out of the past 44 years, but he said the system was a disgrace. And then a week later, he was in New York meeting with a group of small businessmen at Club 21. Henry Ford and other small businessmen were there. And he told these small businessmen, don't worry about your taxes, it's going to take me a year to look it over anyway. But all during that speech, the acceptance speech, and almost every day since, he's talked about the rich. How the rich get away with everything. The rich get away with everything. And they get all the loopholes, loopholes, loopholes. That's all you hear from Governor Carter when he talks about taxes. Loopholes. It's one of those buzzwords that's supposed to upset the American people, divide the American people, pit one group of Americans against another group of Americans. I like to remind Governor Carter from time to time that one of those loopholes, or maybe it's not a loophole, I didn't think it was when I voted for it, it's called the investment tax credit. It's to stimulate the economy, provide more jobs, give businessmen and farmers and others a break so they can stay in agriculture, stay in business, or expand their production or expand their plant and buy new machinery. Well, Mr. Carter's tax liability in 1975 was $68,000. It's not bad. Then he took off $41,000 for the investment tax credit. So he paid the Treasury $17,000-some-odd, or about 12.8% of his income. Now, I don't quarrel with his taking off the investment tax credit. I'm for it. But I quarrel with the hypocrisy of standing before American audiences and bleating and pleading to American audiences, some who are in the poverty class and some slightly above, that it's always the rich that benefit, and talks about loopholes and doesn't level with the American people. And that's what this campaign's all about. And that's what it's about in Maine. That's what it's about in Kansas. In that same interview, he said, and I think this is very important in the state of Maine, he declared he would treat all income alike. In other words, he would eliminate the present treatment of capital gains and losses, which would substantially increase taxes on farmers in Maine who sold their farmland for one example, or had breeding stock for another example. He could double the tax on a retired couple who sold a few shares of stock they owned. But also, and I say this with the utmost significance, it would dramatically increase the taxes for the Maine timber industry. No longer would timber be accorded capital gains treatment as it is now. That's the present law. But he says treat all income the same. And I don't have to tell you how many millions of dollars that would drain out of the Maine economy. It would hinder capital formation and increase unemployment. And would reduce the money available for those workers who are fortunate enough to keep their jobs. So that's another thing to keep in mind in the state of Maine. And I know the importance of the timber industry to the state of Maine. I wonder if Governor Carter knows the importance. Or will he have some way to explain it away as he always has in the past? But now he's got another tax reform. He just loves tax reform. His most recent interview was in Liberty Magazine, the September-October 76 issue. It's a Seventh-day Adventist magazine. And he told the Seventh-day Adventist interviewer that he would, and I quote, these are his words, not mine, these are the words of Governor Carter, favor the taxation of church property other than the church building itself. Let me read that one more time. Favor the taxation of church property other than the church building itself. Now, I didn't say that. He said it. Now, taxing church schools and church hospitals, orphanages, must certainly be one of the worst ways imaginable to raise additional tax revenues for federal, state, or local governments. I don't know whether he has in mind a property tax or an income tax or what. He hasn't said. President Ford said this afternoon, this administration, the Ford administration now, and the Ford-Dole administration in January, and I quote, neither plans nor supports any efforts to tax churches beyond the present scope of federal taxation. And frankly, and I'm not shocked very easily, but I'm shocked that Mr. Carter would so casually propose such an increase in the tax burdens on our nation's churches. But it indicates and demonstrates and underscores again the man doesn't have the experience.